You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Every story of thought and thinking runs into its own kinds of problems. Progressive accounts do well showing how predecessors were not quite as sharp or as moral as we are, but they have a hard time saying what might come to pass in years or generations to come. Conservative narratives have to distinguish between things worthy to conserve and things best left to antiquarians. Revolutionary accounts anticipate radical ruptures, but tend to neglect good things that revolutions tend to leave behind or even smash to bits. And Christian stories of the history of thought face the struggle of deciding when to say, with Jesus in Matthew, that whoever is not with us is against us, and when to say, with Jesus in Mark, that whoever is not against us is with us. Gerald Bray's book, Athens and Jerusalem, Philosophy, Theology, and the Mind of Christ, takes up that work of distinguishing influences of Christian theology from resistance to the same, and Dr. Bray is here to talk to us about that project. Gerald, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
I imagine many of our listeners will pick up on the source of your title, namely the famous rhetorical question from North African theologian Tertullian, what does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? And early in the book, you acknowledge that even by Tertullian's day, neither Athens nor Jerusalem was a center of political or commercial power within Rome's empire. Why does Tertullian reach for these two cities, and why do these names persist to influence your own book?
Well, they became metaphors, really. Of course, you know, Christians are familiar with Jerusalem being used in this way because that's the way it's used very often in the Bible. You know, we talk about Jerusalem not only as a city in Palestine, but also as the dwelling place of God, the place of worship, and so on. And even in the New Testament, we talk about the heavenly Jerusalem and so on. So, you know, we're quite familiar with that. I think as far as Athens is concerned, well, Athens was the intellectual center of ancient Greece. And even in Tertullian's day, it was still what we would today call a university town, you know, with plenty of philosophical schools and so on. And it had also come to be used metaphorically for the whole tradition of Greek philosophy. I mean, not all Greek philosophers went to Athens or came from there, but it had become symbolic in a sense.
Very good. Your chapter on Greek thought starts where any investigation of Greek thought should, namely on the vast plurality of Greek notions of goodness, of divinity, and of just about every important question. This is a book that surveys philosophical and theological movements from a dizzying span of historical moments. So just give us the basics and let our listeners read your book for more details, but give them somewhere to start thinking. What tendencies and what emphases in Greek thought resonated most with those early Christian thinkers and writers?
Oh, well, I think the thing about the ancient Greek philosophers is that, of course, they were coming at reality, what, you know, material reality, from any number of vantage points and perspectives. But what resonated, I think, with the early Christians was first of all the sense that there's a unity in the material world. That somehow or other, it all hangs together. And, you know, investigating this is what, you know, someone like Aristotle was trying to do. And, of course, that, you know, appealed to the early Christians. But also, and perhaps more importantly, was the sense that the answer to that question, the solution, was not going to be found in the material objects themselves. You know, you could talk about cause and effect and so on, but that there was some higher reality, an invisible, spiritual, mental, you know, whatever word you want to use, reality that could not be reduced to to matter as we understand it, but with something behind that, a mind that had put it all together. And of course, that ties in extremely well with the Bible, which starts with a creator God who exists independently of the material universe which he has created. And so that it's that sense. And you get this very much in Plato, of course, but also one way or another in most of the Greek philosophers, this belief that you have to go beyond the physical to the metaphysical. And that was an open door for Christians who could turn around and say, well, we have the answer to that. We're connected with the metaphysical because that is the God of the Bible.
Very good. Now, I mean, one question that, occurs to me is that there's a few different paths to monotheism, if you will. I mean, Aristotle seems to have reasoned himself to a primary mover towards which, reality tends. Whereas Moses has an encounter with a God who claims to be a singular God. Did that relationship between reason and revelation show up as tension in those early Christian writings? Did it show up as harmony? Or is there a spectrum of relationships between reason and revelation in those early Christian books?
Well, in the very early Christian literature, in the sort of second century, third century, that sort of time, you get the sense that the philosophers were seeking after something that they knew had to be there, but they didn't know how to go about it, and so it's not so much that their intentions were wrong, but they didn't have the ability to come to a solution of these difficulties because they didn't have revelation. And, given the nature of creation, you can't stand back from it. You can't rise above it unless whatever is there above it comes to you and tells you about itself. And of course, this doesn't happen with the Greek philosophers. I mean, the prime mover, if you like, with Aristotle, didn't appear to Aristotle and say, hello, I'm the prime mover, and take it from me that this is how it all happened. That was just Aristotle's speculation, really. Whereas in the case of the scriptures of the Bible, it was really the other way around. I mean, Moses wasn't particularly looking for the source of reality. But the God of Abraham, the God of the Bible, came to him. I suppose really introduced him to a world of which he had no direct knowledge and which, if we're honest, he wasn't particularly looking for either.
That makes good sense. Now, this book mainly concerns itself with Christian thinking and Christian theology's interactions with philosophy, but you note early in the book that in the 7th century AD, Muhammad recognizes that the book, as a core component of worshiping communities' lives, has a special power. When our listeners pause and reflect on the notion that Jews and Christians are people of the book, to use the Quran's phrase, what does that designation fruitfully draw our attention to? What do we see when we think about these traditions as traditions of the book?
Well, I think that the book, of course, is a way of preserving the content of Revelation. Revelation was not an exclusively Jewish idea. you did have in the Greek world, oracles and, you know, various people who claimed to be inspired with some kind of spiritual power, and that, you know, they would be able to reveal mysteries hidden from ordinary people. But of course, this was done on an ad hoc, you know, one-to-one personal basis. It wasn't something that transcended the circumstances of the moment. And with the biblical revelation, of course, it began orally. I mean, God spoke to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. They did not write down what they heard. I mean, writing, as far as we know, either began with Moses or certainly with the tradition of Moses. I mean, that's where the law given on Mount Sinai. And the transition from oral to written communication is really a tradition, a transition from the immediate to the longer term. Because you know, once you have a written revelation, you don't have to wait each time for God to speak, and God to speak through a particular person or in a particular place. And then he might say something, anything really. You know, there was no predicting what the oracle would say. But once it's written down, then you have a stability there and a permanence and a sense that the person speaking, in this case God, transcends the circumstances of the moment. And this is a very powerful thing because, I mean, if you take just a very simple example from the Ten Commandments, I mean, thou shalt not kill. Is this a precept given to Moses on a particular occasion with respect to somebody that he was dealing with at the time? So you're not to kill your brother or Pharaoh or whatever, but that it doesn't have permanent relevance, shall we say. You know, it's just advice for now. Or is this something that is a principle that is meant to transcend the particular circumstances in which we are in and become the basis for a whole way of life? And of course, we know that it was the second thing that is what was intended. And so you have in the book a series of precepts, rules and regulations, if you like, that are meant to apply in every situation, to be a guide to a permanent way of life. And it's this that is a strength because, first of all, it's the same message everywhere. And it's public. I mean, you don't have to, go behind closed doors and, find a prophet or whatever who will give you advice. But you have something laid out in front of you that everybody sees, that everybody can at least pay lip service to. Whether they obey it or not is perhaps another issue, but at least it's there. And it's a standard by which conduct can be measured. That, of course, creates community. It creates stability. It allows also for judgment, because you can say to somebody, you aren't living up to the standard which has been revealed. Which you can't really do if it's just a purely oral thing, because, we could say, well, you know, God has said one thing to you, but he said something quite different to me. And who are you to tell me that, you know, he hasn't spoken to me in that way? So the transition to writing is actually a very important one. And Muhammad, is interestingly, saw this because, of course, he came from a society in Arabia which didn't have this sort of thing, which, you know, was still sort of back in the oral stage. And it was chaos, well, relatively speaking. And he could look at Jews and Christians whom he saw around him and said, well, they, you know, they have a standard, they have a written record, and they can refer to that and order their beliefs and their lives accordingly. And he saw the strength of that, and so went about and produced his own version.
Very good, very good. Now, the Book of Acts uses the Greek noun hados, translated in English as the way, usually, to name whatever is happening in that community that spreads forth from the disciples of Jesus to lands as far-flung as Europe and North Africa and all over the world, really. One of the things that you write about that early community is that it is a community that is elite, but not elitist, spiritually speaking. So what might our listeners understand when we start with that distinction between elite and elitist?
It's elite in the sense that it's the Christian people, well, indeed Jewish people, are a chosen race, you know, a peculiar people, sort of called to be children of God. And it's not a universal thing. You know, the nature of salvation, if you contrast, say, what God did with Noah and the flood, that after the flood, the world sort of went on as it had gone on before, and you know, the preservation of the human race after the flood is a universal thing. I mean, whether you particularly wanted it or not, you were being preserved, and that's the message of Noah. Whereas when it comes to Abraham and the children of Abraham, it's a very specific calling to a particular person. And so Abraham is chosen out of the peoples of the world. And God's revelation to him, and then subsequently, through the Israelite people, and indeed to the coming of Christ, and the conversion of Christians, is a genuine revelation to particular people. It's not like the final judgment, which will appear, which will cover the entire world, and you won't have a choice as to whether you, pay attention or not. So in that sense, you could say Christians were chosen out of the world, rather than the world itself changing. So in, you could call that an elite. You know, the Christians were children of God, soldiers of God, whatever word you want to use, but they were a distinct segment of humanity, not humanity as a whole. On the other hand, Christian belief is not elitist because it doesn't say, we're all right, we have the answers, and you poor people, tough, you know, you're just going to hell. The Christian message is a missionary message. It's an event, the whole concept of mission, of evangelism, of going out and trying to win people over. We don't look at unbelievers and say, poor you, you just missed out, or something like that. we say, well, the message that we have received is one which is intended for you as well. And we want you to join in. We want you to belong. We're not trying to keep you out. I suppose, if I could tell a story about this, I remember some years ago going on a tour, and I was in Malaysia. I was actually in Singapore, but I went on this tour into Malaysia, and we were taken to a local mosque. And the tour guide said to us, you cannot go into the mosque. And I said, why not? And she said, because you're not Muslim. And I said, you mean to say that this mosque is restricted to Muslims? And she said, yes. And I said, well, that's very different from our Christian faith. I said, because we would never dream of keeping non-Christians out of the church, to visit. If you want to attend a service or something like that, if you're not a Christian, I mean, that you're very welcome to come in and hear the gospel. And the reply I got from the guide was, well, that's because you don't take your religion seriously. And, you're prepared to compromise by allowing unbelievers into your community. And I said, well, no, not at all. It's because we want them to hear the message and accept it. If they don't accept it, it's not because we haven't spoken to them or we haven't gone out to them and urged them to do so. It's entirely on their side. I mean, whatever reason they might give for rejecting, it's not because we as Christians have shut them out. And so in that sense, we're not elitist.
I want to move forward to some medieval thought. And some of our listeners, when they hear the philosophical terms nominalism and realism, they might connect these medieval notions to recent books like Richard Weaver's Ideas Have Consequences or even Alistair MacIntyre's After Virtue. But I imagine not many would connect nominalism and realism to medieval debates over the slave trade. So your book does. So leave our listeners some reasons to go and read your book, but give us a taste of how those debates relate to each other. How do nominalism, realism, and the slave trade relate to each other in medieval writing?
Oh, well, that's a huge topic. The first thing I would say is that I don't think many of the people who read my book will have much idea of what realism and nominalism are to begin with.
Very peculiar listeners, Dr. Bray.
Yes, I'm sure you do. But I think people who do know about these things need to realize that they are a kind of elite, in their own way. And that these words get used, of course, in different contexts with slightly different meanings or different applications, if you like, over time. And that's fine. I mean, that's fair enough. But I think basically, when it comes down to it, I mean, the difference between realism and nominalism is really just a different way of stating the difference between classical Platonism and Aristotelianism. That realism, is the belief that what is real is in the mind. It is ideal and ideal principles, which are then reproduced in material contexts to varying degrees of accuracy, you might say. You know that what we see around us is an expression invariably in some corrupted form, whether it's seriously corrupted or even just a little bit corrupted, it's still not the original. And You know, we have to look back behind what we see around us to figure out, you know, what is really there. Whereas nominalism is the opposite in a sense. It says, well, you know, material reality is what there is. We name things, and nominalism deals with naming. We classify things according to, you know, various criteria, which we see around us, which we see in our world. And then we work out from there, you know, what is really going on. And I think that's, you know, that's the basic starting point. Now, I mean, when it comes to things like slavery, well, I suppose the ultimate question there is, what is a human being? Because, you know, is a human being something which is determined in principle, you know, by an idea or by some kind of, I don't know what word you want to use, supreme power or something like that, and all human beings stem from that origin, or, you know, do we look around us, our world, and see individuals and sort of group them together and assume, you know, we come up with a notion of common humanity, which might not be there. And of course, you see in, you know, 16th century, for example, 17th century, when the European explorers went around the world, it was an open question for some as to whether American Indians, for example, were actually human. You know, and also Africans and so on. And of course, slavery in the modern world was really based on that principle. You know, a European could not enslave another European. I mean, you know, an Englishman would not enslave French people, for example. But when it came to, say, Aztecs or Congolese or something like this, you know, where the question of whether these people were really human comes into play. If you don't think they are, well, then, you know, slavery is no worse than, say, domesticating a horse or something like that. You're doing something to a being which is inferior, and we tend to forget. You see that, I mean, even in the 18th century, after American independence, the slave population was counted in a different way from the free population. That a slave was regarded, I think I'm right in saying, as three-fifths of a person.
Yep, the infamous three-fifths compromise in the original text of the Constitution.
That's right. I got the math. I'm not too sure about the mathematics, but the fact that that was even conceivable, that people could think that they could say things like that, it really clashes with what you might call a realist point of view.
Right. And, you know, that I think that attending to this history is a good cure for the sometimes unreflective progressive narrative that everyone was all right with slavery until a certain point in history. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, these disputes over history go back well over a millennium. And that, you know, Christian writing, at least as far back as Gregory of Nyssa, calls into question, you know, the fundamental morality or immorality of slave trade in the first place.
Oh, yes. I think though one of the differences between ancient slavery and what you might call early modern slavery is that, say, in biblical times or in, you know, the early church period, people knew that slaves were usually captives, you know, from the defeated an army or something like that, and then people were enslaved. Well, you couldn't deny that these people were human, because, you know, you've been fighting them, and slavery was the penalty that you paid for losing a war or something like this. And, you know, you could say, well, the alternative would be put to death. And, you know, if you're given a choice between being slaughtered and being enslaved, slavery doesn't appear quite so bad, perhaps, you know, because, and of course, in ancient times, there were mechanisms by which slaves could buy their freedom, achieve their freedom. And of course, you find that in the Old Testament as well, you know, that there's a process you can go through to bring your own personal slavery to an end. So that I don't think that the issue was quite the same. Whereas in modern times, there really was an issue, you know, of the people that you're going to enslave, are they human? And which is a different kind of argument. Because they weren't mentioned in the Bible. I mean, when the Europeans got to the Americas, found these people running around, saw them in, you know, what to them were very primitive conditions, they said, well, are they really human? And if they're not, you know, why can't we enslave them? Or, you know, the equivalent, rather like domesticating a wild animal, which is a different way of thinking about it.
Indeed. And we could talk about this for some time, but we have but an hour. So I want to move forward to Galileo. I imagine that we'd see something about Galileo in an intellectual history of this sort. What I didn't expect was a strong connection between Galileo and Protestant communities. That's something that the conventional narratives about Galileo versus Rome tends to neglect. So what kinds of communication were happening between Galileo and European Protestants? And how did Galileo's famous dispute with Rome relate to this engagement with Rome's ecclesial rivals?
I think the first thing we have to say about this is connection between Galileo and some European Protestants. You know, not all. That's the first thing, you know, you have to say. Protestantism, by its nature, was more open to innovation and, you know, differences of opinion and so on. Not so much because the Protestant people wanted that. I mean, actual Protestant communities believed just as much as the Catholic Church that, you know, they held the truth and nothing but the truth and the whole truth. But the problem was they couldn't enforce this. If you had Lutherans and Reformed and, you know, Mennonites and what have you, wandering around and disagreeing with each other, although all of them would claim to be in possession of the truth, you know, in an exclusive way, in practice, they had to be tolerant of people who disagreed with them, you know, on particular things, because they didn't have the power or the ability to push their particular line, you know, on everybody. And where they came together these different groups. And this was particularly the case in the Netherlands, because if you look at a map and think in terms of water transport, which was, of course, the most effective form of transport at that time, you see that the rivers all flow down in, you know, to Northern Europe, and what is now the Netherlands is where they sort of met the sea, as it were, the Rhine and so on. So there were a lot of traders and what have you would ply that route, and the Netherlands became a kind of home for all sorts of people and ideas. And they had to find some way of living together. It wasn't easy. And to imagine that they had a happy compromise would be going too far, because they did in fact, you know, fight each other. But still, you know, they found themselves having to make room for different people. And it was among them, really, that those people, that the sympathy with Galileo was most obvious, because Galileo found himself at odds with the papacy. And that, of course, was something that all Protestants could sympathize with, because they were all at odds with the papacy. And the fact that Galileo might be at odds with the papacy in a slightly different way from the way that they were, or in different circumstances and so on, would be a secondary issue. I mean, Galileo was not a Protestant. You know, he was Italian. He was culturally and intellectually rather different from, say, the average Dutch Protestant or somebody like this. But the fact that he was protesting against what all the Protestants regarded as the tyranny of Rome was a good thing, you know, that in itself. And I think it was more that than, is Galileo right? That question was secondary in the minds of many people. And I think it just happened to be true, you know, that they in a way they took a risk by backing Galileo, because they didn't really know, whether he was right. You might say the same with Copernicus a generation or two before. Luther and Melanchthon and so on, they didn't have any time for Copernicus. They thought he was completely wrong, and so on. So it's not all Protestants were on the side of, you know, scientific experiment and so on. So they were taking a risk in a sense, you know, at the time. But, you know, as it turned out, the risk was shown to be worth taking. And of course, they could look back, you know, and see, well, we bet on the right horse, if you like. You know, we won the argument in that way. I think another thing to bear in mind is that the Protestants who supported Galileo, which they did mainly because, you know, he was in trouble with the papacy, didn't actually have to deal with him personally. I mean, Galileo was under house arrest, you know, in Florence or wherever, and, you know, the Protestants who printed his material, who publicized his views in Amsterdam or you know, Rotterdam or whatever, I didn't have to deal with him. You know, he wasn't round the corner giving lectures and stirring people up against the local authorities. And so it was easier to do this. I think when I think about this, if you think back to the Cold War era, how many people in Western countries, United States and elsewhere, were supportive of dissidents in the Soviet Union, because we didn't really know any of them. They were against the tyranny, and so we thought, well, we would support them because they're against the tyranny. But I think of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, when he was let go from the Soviet Union and landed up in the United States. And at first, he was lionized as a hero, because he'd stood up to the evil empire and so on. But after he'd been in America for a year or two, he began to see things wrong with it and started to be quite critical of the United States. And a lot of people who had originally supported him kind of dropped him like a hot potato. They weren't interested in that. I kind of think of that as a sort of parallel with, if Galileo had escaped, if he'd gone to a Protestant place, how would he have been received? Would he have been treated as a hero? Probably at the beginning, yes, because he fled the clutches of the Pope. But if after a while, faded and you were just looking at what he had to say, there might have been a good deal less enthusiasm. Well, we don't know the answer to that. Because it didn't happen, but I think we need to be a bit humble about this.
That makes good sense. That makes good sense. I want to stick around Northern Europe, because when you turn to the Enlightenment, you point to Spinoza as one of the key figures in the conflict between the new philosophies and the more traditional theologies. So, when people think about the Enlightenment, a lot of people start with French figures or even Scottish figures. What makes Spinoza such a key figure in this story of conflict between philosophy and theology?
Well, Spinoza was an outsider from the beginning. And I think we have to realize this, his family, not he himself, but his family, had been forced to leave Portugal, in the late 16th, 15th century, when Jews were expelled, because he was a Jewish person, from there. And the only place that, well, maybe not the only place, but the place they went was the Netherlands, because of its relative openness to these different ideas. So he, from the beginning, he belonged to a refugee Jewish community in the Netherlands and was therefore detached, really from the wider society. He didn't really owe anybody anything, shall we say. He wasn't connected in that way. But Spinoza was intelligent enough to see that Judaism really didn't have a great deal to offer. Now, I don't want to offend Jewish people about this, but the way Spinoza looked at it, he saw the sacrifices of the Old Testament, the rituals in the synagogue, and so on, and basically concluded that it was a lot of nonsense. It didn't make sense. And this was entirely within the Jewish community. It had nothing to do with the wider Christian community. And he was actually expelled from the synagogue in Amsterdam, I believe it was, when he was like 23, something like this. And of course, at the time, I mean, what did you do? You know, if you were going to be expelled from a synagogue or anything, you had to go somewhere. And you couldn't just float around as a nothing. And so he became a kind of nominal Christian by default, in a way, but not because he actually believed it. And of course, when he started looking at Christianity, he saw, from his point of view, that Christianity was just as irrational and meaningless as Judaism. You know, he didn't really take that on board. But because, you see, again, it's perception, isn't it, as much as anything else? I mean, the Christian people that Spinoza associated with didn't really think of him as a fellow Christian. I mean, he was a Portuguese, a refugee Portuguese Jew, as far as they were concerned. But because of this, he wasn't part of, you know, a community particularly. He kind of lived in a no man's land intellectually. And I mean, really by a series of accidents, I suppose you'd have to say, somehow or other he managed to get, you know, his thoughts published. And like a lot of these things, they fell on ears that were looking for something different. I mean, we're discontent. There were a lot of people discontented because in the Christian world at that time, as I say, you had all these different denominations, different people running around claiming to have absolute truth. And the realization with among certain people that can't be right. I mean, you can't have five or six different groups all having absolute truth, but not agreeing with each other. And so to conclude from that none of them is right, they're all wrong, is kind of a neutral position, you might say. You know, Spinoza said, well, they're all wrong because they're starting in the wrong place and asking the wrong questions, and therefore, of course, coming up with the wrong answers. And so what do you do? Well, you have to find a common denominator. What's the common denominator? Well, the common denominator is reason, human reason, according to him. And there was, of course, a strong tradition in the Christian world of reason and philosophy as well. I mean, if you know, go back to Aquinas and people like this, it wasn't a completely foreign idea. And there were other people who were Christians of a kind, at least, like René Descartes, for example, you know, who was a Christian of a sort, or Thomas Hobbes, you know, who were around, who expressed their rationalism within a traditionally Christian framework, you might say. But Spinoza, who didn't belong to that world, that kind of intellectual world, was able to make the same philosophical points without the religious overlay, you know, because he didn't inherit it or he wasn't part of it. So that's a big thing. I mean, the person, if anybody wants to follow this in greater detail, the man who has done more than anybody else to bring Spinoza into view in this way is a man called Jonathan Israel, who has written several important books on the Enlightenment and has recently written a book on Spinoza himself. It's Israel's belief that, you know, the whole Enlightenment really comes out of Spinoza. Now, he may be exaggerating that to some degree, but he has a massive amount of scholarship behind him, you know, to point this out. And of course, I don't suppose I have to say that one of the nice things about Jonathan Israel is you don't have to ask what religious group he comes from. I mean, his name is a giveaway, really. And in that sense, there's an affinity with Spinoza, I suppose, which, you know, is no doubt part of the attraction. But that's where to go if you want to follow that up in detail. You know, Jonathan Israel is the man to look to.
Very good. Chapter 7 is the book's longest chapter, and it runs all the way from Spinoza to Friedrich Nietzsche. And I want to spend a bit of time on your reading of Nietzsche today. You write that Nietzsche called for some kind of return to a pre-Christian moral past. But when I've taught Nietzsche's genealogy of morals, you know, I tend to emphasize the part of his third essay that says that moral history can't go backwards, that any kind of serious atheist philosophy has to be post-Christian, not a return to pre-Christian paganism. So I want to talk about his larger corpus for a moment. You know, if it's not the third essay of Genealogy of Morals, what parts of Nietzsche's writings, considered broadly, tend to call for some kind of return to paganism?
Well, yeah, I mean, Nietzsche, of course, you know, there are many facets to his thought. But basically, I think what he did was he rediscovered the importance of the pre-Socratics. You know, Heraclides and Pythagoras and people like this. And he argued, when he looked at Greek philosophy, I mean, he thought that Plato and Aristotle were second-rate minds who had, you know, corrupted the pure thinking of an earlier time. And so, well, that doesn't have a direct connection with Christianity because, you know, this is pre-Platonic in a way. Nevertheless, I think here, you know, as far as Nietzsche was concerned, the way forward is a way back to the primitive simplicity. You know, let's sweep away all the corruption of centuries of scholasticism and you know, civilization and so on, and you know, get back to humanity and the raw kind of thing. And the pre-Socratics, you know, his rehabilitation, you might say, of them, you know, was very key to this. How much of that makes sense, and how much of it, you know, really chimes in with other things that Nietzsche said, well, that's another issue. Of course, we all know that Nietzsche went mad in his own lifetime. I mean, he was an extraordinary person in that way. I think something that would be worth looking at that I discovered, I didn't realize, the lectures that Abraham Kuyper gave at Princeton, you know, which have been published, and they're easy to get hold of, his lectures on Calvinism. In one of those, he actually has an analysis of Nietzsche. And the interesting thing is, Nietzsche was still alive when Kuyper was giving these lectures. Kuyper was aware of Nietzsche in a way that most people weren't. I mean, the people sitting listening to him in Princeton probably never heard of Nietzsche for the most part. And he was very prescient. I mean, he saw you know, the contradictions in Nietzsche's thought, and predicted where it would all end up. You know, he said that if this man's ideas, you know, take over, even, you know, part of them in some way, it will destroy Germany. You know, and he was very well aware of that. You know, a generation before it actually happened. So that's what I would say about that.
Okay, very good. Well, here at the end, I want to talk about something that doesn't come from a particular chapter, but happens in various places in the book. So in a few different places, your sentences imply, sometimes more directly and sometimes less directly, that liberal Protestants, process philosophers, Renaissance humanists, and some other folks who call themselves Christian writers are something other than Christian. So in broad terms, are you inclined to say that Hartshorn and Spong and Erasmus misrepresent themselves when they call themselves Christian writers? Do they misunderstand their own relationships with Christian writing, or is something else going on when these writers, again, call themselves Christian writers, but something else is going on?
Yeah, well, that's a very difficult question, isn't it, really? I mean, it's not for me to pass judgment on these people particularly, but I think what I would say is that they're people who have come out of a basically Christian culture. You know, that's where they come from, but they haven't really grasped the integrity of that culture. I don't know how to put it in a different way, but maybe something like they don't see the Bible as a coherent, systematic way of thinking. They may see it as, you know, a moral challenge to our society, or, you know, a stage on the way to a further development of humanity or something like this. But it, the fact that it's a package, that it's its own thing, you know, it doesn't need to be supplemented in this way, and indeed trying to supplement it with other things perverts it sooner or later. That what they're doing is repeating the error of the Gnostics of the second century. You know, that it's a kind of syncretism. Now, I mean, as I say, I'm very cautious about, you know, anathematizing these people. It's very easy to do, and there are certain, you know, Christian voices which are only too eager to do that. You know, they seem to have the keys of death and hell, and are just, you know, opening the gates and pushing all these people in. I'm very cautious about that sort of thing. I don't want to go there particularly, because I'm not their judge. But I think if you look at the things that they've produced and the results that they have, it's very hard to see how they are consistent with the teaching of Scripture. I mean, for what it's worth, the only person of the ones you've mentioned that I've actually met is John Shelby Spong. I mean, I've heard him lecture, and I think he himself, from what I can recall, would not really think of himself as a Christian. He called himself Unitarian Universalist, was his thing. And that was by his own admission. So, you know.
Right. Well, Gerald, I have been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about Athens, Jerusalem, or whatever else as we head for the door?
Well, I want people to carry on thinking about the relationship between human thought and divine revelation. And I think if I make any point at all, it is to say human thought can often be very impressive and attractive, but at the end of the day, it is really the thoughts of human beings who are relative, in the universe, and that we may think various things and we may have reasons to think them, but we are fallible. And you know, a good scientist is always trying to disprove his own theories, to falsify, you know, the so-called laws that he is investigating, because he knows that what we think of as scientific laws are a stage on the way to a deeper knowledge, to a deeper understanding. And, you know, to be aware of that it's a constantly moving and developing thing. Whereas divine revelation, on the other hand, is an opening to a world that does not change, that is always the same, but that always has something to say to a world that does change. The fact that divine revelation was given a long time ago does not mean that it's out of date. It's still as relevant today as it was when it was first given. And we have set our task today in our own day and age is to find the right way to communicate that to our contemporaries. And I would encourage Christians to do this. I think that one of the problems in the Christian world today is that too many Christians have stopped thinking. They've turned Christianity into an emotional experience. And while there's nothing wrong with emotional experience in itself, it can't be detached from the life of the mind.
Gerald Bray, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is Athens and Jerusalem from Lexham Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.